Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the man who continues to persist and exist, Mr. Spencer Williams.
Yep, I'm still here.
Yes, he is still here. This is not a ghost. We are not doing AI regeneration of his voice.
Better not.
Yeah, maybe.
No,
we'll see how the success of that.
No consent.
And you just heard her. That is intern Sarah. She is with us as well.
Hi again.
And hopefully she's not going to talk about siding with serial killers or talking about septic tanks. Because we have a great show in store for you as we are going to be talking about the third entry in a almost 3-decade-long saga franchise. And that is 28 years later. Stick around as we dive into this, talk about the nitty-gritty, some of the cool ways of how this film was actually filmed, and all the great stuff. So, but before we do that, Spencer, why don't you give us them opening credits?
Tune into brand new episodes each and every week.
Week!
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. Also, we have a Blue Sky account at Filmlosophers Podcast.
Yeah.
That's right. We have a Blue Sky account over at Filmlosophers Podcast at Blue Sky Social, which I just realized I probably haven't posted much on it. I am sorry.
No, we have not. I've followed it.
Well, then you should handle it. I'm going to hand that over to you after the episode's over. Cool.
Do on that.
Everything that you should be doing on others. That's right. We got a website. If you head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com, there we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and it's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers, and give us a follow or subscribe. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
Yes, we have.
We will leave you the social links at the end of the episode. We have a great show in stores. We're going to be talking about a movie that has been long awaited and honestly has been one that we haven't been sure as to what direction it's going to go. But knowing the people who are, you know, directing the ship, we knew it was probably going to go in a good direction. And so you'll find out what we think about that in a little bit. But first,
no!
We're going to do a little conspiracy theory showdown. Now, I wanted to add a fun twist to this, and I kind of touched upon it last time when intern manager or manager intern, whatever managing her role is.
You don't even know the title you gave her.
I gave it to her. It was her job to remember it, and she keeps forgetting any episode. We did it once with her on the show, and so I kind of want to try it again and see how you guys feel about it. And so I'm actually excited to present this conspiracy theory showdown. So the way this works is as follows. I am going to present to you two potential conspiracy theories. Your jobs are to figure out which one seems more plausible. Now, they both might be bat poop crazy, off the wall bonkers, but you need to find the one that might be more plausible. There's no right or wrong answer. There just has to be a answer. All right?
All right.
I'm looking at you, Spence.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. So here's the theories. So theory one. Now, this is going to harken to a movie from way back when. But I know you. So it's actually a bridging kind of conspiracy theory. And it includes a movie that you're familiar with, Spencer, and I'm sure Sarah's familiar with it as well. Okay. So one of the movies is a movie from the 90s called Friday. Now, I don't know if everybody's seen Friday.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a particular scene in that movie when Ice Cube's character, Craig, ends up running up to Debo, who is he's kind of the stereotypical character for that African American thuggish, like large brooding type. His name is Debo in the movie. I am completely apologetic to the actual actor or what his name is. If somebody wants to look it up so I can say his actual name. But in the clip, are we looking?
We're looking currently right now, pulling it up.
There's too many things with the name Friday in it before
Tommy
that.
Lister Jr.
Is that him? He plays Debo. Tommy Lister Jr. Okay. So Tommy Lister Jr. plays a character named Debo. He's like the neighborhood bully. And in the course of this, he ends up punching a woman, which then upsets her best friend, who is a girl that Craig is trying to get with. So in the end, it ends into this huge fight between Craig, Ice Cube's Craig, and Tommy Lister Jr.'s Debo. At this point, Craig ends up somehow swinging so hard that he punches Debo so hard that he flies up and then falls flat on the concrete. At this point, Chris Tucker's character comes over and yells in his face, "You got knocked the F out." That's what everybody knows. Yeah. Now, here's where the conspiracy theory comes into play. So, in that moment, when Craig punches Debo and he knocks him out, Debo begins to dream. And he dreams that he's the president in the future. And his job is to save the planet Earth from a potential extinction / destruction of the planet. And so he has to recruit an ex-soldier played by Bruce Willis to find this quote-unquote fifth element to help save the world from utter destruction. That's the first theory. Mm-hmm. So the theory is that when Debo gets knocked out, he dreams that he's the president, which is the story that then occurs in The Fifth Element.
Okay.
That's the first one.
Okay.
All right.
No, I don't want to say anything. Never mind.
So here's conspiracy theory number two. The conspiracy theory is in the whereabouts from pretty much after the third Back to the Future film. There's not a lot that we know of that's canon after the fact of everything else, like of when Doc gets older, what happens.
I mean, technically that video game is supposed to be canon to the story.
But it's not like the end of his life, like towards like the latter part. Like this is still closer to when Marty's younger and so forth. Like we're talking like when Doc gets older in those ages.
Oh, okay.
So we know that old men don't listen and old dogs can't learn new tricks. So he's probably going to figure out a way to time travel again. So the theory is that when Doc got older into his years, he found a way to not only create with another DeLorean a time machine that pretty much can travel through time both forward and back, but can also practically teleport into some random place in the universe. And so almost, but not quite to the level of a TARDIS, because obviously there's not a lot of room in a DeLorean. We know this.
Yeah.
It's so very tiny. Whereas the TARDIS is essentially a whole apartment building in itself.
Yes.
So what ends up happening is Doc ends up going so far back and to a whole different galaxy, if you will, that he shows up during the inception of this one planet that is looking to figure out how to build their empire. And Doc introduces them to certain kinds of steel and metallurgy. And they refer to him as the man in the DeLorean. So they ultimately then began to refer to themselves as Mandalorians. Because of that metallurgy kind of lesson and everything else, he's taught them that. Now, he has been able to jump back through time, but he's never been able to really get back to his own time and space, which is why
it's like quantum leap.
Exactly.
For
exactly. Or sliders. And ultimately he does end up in a space where he lands somewhere where he decides to stay because it's a peaceful place. And he ends up living there. Although he does grow disgruntled, he ends up tearing apart the DeLorean, no longer being able to time travel because he thinks he's happy. And he ends up in a planet that is potentially a peaceful planet, where we then see him show up in the Mandalorian series, where he serves the King and Queen, which is played uniquely by Jack Black and Lizzo.
Yeah.
And so we see how his story ultimately follows through. So those are your two theories. All right. Now, what I want you guys to do is I want you to figure out which one you think is more plausible.
The first one.
You think the first one is more plausible?
Yes.
Tell me why.
Because it makes a lot of sense for this guy who just got beat up to, if last thing he has is Chris Tucker's face in his face, like, he's going to want to get revenge, and he can do that.
And who is the main loud person in The Fifth Element?
Yeah. Rudy.
It's Chris Tucker.
Yeah. So it makes a lot of sense. Doc Brown has too much sense for all that nonsense you just spewed. Also, he's married and also has two kids.
I mean, something could have happened to Clara. The kids might not want to talk to him anymore. You don't know.
Oh, that's so dark.
You don't know. I mean, this man might be on the hunt for peace.
He literally spent so much time going over, you know, consequences and cause and effect that I just don't see him like going that far out like that.
So you think the first one is more plausible?
Yes.
All right. What about you, Sarah?
I have to fully agree because it is a hard, like, it, I hear you out. I hear you out.
No,
it's
I'm
a
just...
hard pull to be, to, I hear out more on the first option for Friday and Fifth Element because Ruby Rod, I love, so fancy. But for the second option, for it being Back to the Future, and then he enters, like, he goes so far back that he enters the Star Wars universe, and the interest, I don't know enough, I'm still learning about the people of Mandalore, that it's one of those things where I'd want to believe, but I can't fully get behind.
I feel like it's too out of character for the man.
Yeah. I mean, you never know.
And okay. Some of the people would, like, some of the people of Mandalore would probably act a bit different than, you know,
Great Scott.
Yeah,
hey. I feel like that might be a thing.
They'd be more refined, maybe.
More refined?
I don't know.
Obviously. All right, so you guys are going with the first one.
Well, do you think?
I honestly could see both of them. That's why I posited both of them.
We could see both of them.
Oh, heck yeah. Mandalorian.
That's really pulling
so
the
low-hanging fruit.
That just seemed
not
to fit.
Worth it.
It was like, yes,
no.
I can see that. And then they went ahead and put Christopher Lloyd in the Star Wars universe.
Because
and it's like,
it's Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah. You're lucky I didn't put...
They put Lizzo in there.
You're lucky I didn't put Christopher Lloyd from the Dennis the Menace movies, the hobo with the beans. Like, I'll figure out a way. Either way, it's still like the great thing about conspiracy theories is that they are more than ridiculous, but there's still a sense of possibility to them, even if they sound outlandish.
No possibility.
There's always a possibility, just like the possibility that we finally got the third film in this franchise that we are going to be talking about, and that is our take on Danny Boyle's 28 Years Later. This movie, like I said, has been 3 decades in the making, and we have absolutely been anticipating this movie since its reveal that it was going to be made. The trailer had everybody kind of sitting on at the edge of their seat, and it was just one of those movies where you remember and I hate to say this as kind of like a reference, but like just like 9/11, you know where you were when you first saw it.
I wasn't even born.
This particular movie is like the inception of fast moving zombies and creating the ultimate hype of, you know, having value to handheld footage kind of thing. So let it be said that, you know, we're going to be talking about a lot of these other movies as well with this review, but this is our take on this particular film. So before we move any further, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
It's been almost 3 decades since the Rage virus escaped a biological weapons laboratory. And now, still a ruthlessly enforced quarantine, some have found ways to exist among the infected. One such group of survivors lives on a small island connected to the mainland by a single, heavily defended causeway. When one of the group leaves the island on a mission to into the dark heart of the mainland, he discovers secrets, wonders, and horrors that have mutated not only the infected, but other survivors as well.
Produced and directed by Danny Boyle and written by Alex Garland, the film stars Jodie Comer, Aaron Taylor Johnson, Jack O'Connell, Alfie Williams in his feature film debut, and Ralph Fiennes. A couple pieces of information about the film. Originally, the follow-up was set to be titled 28 Months Later, continuing with the movie's timeline set title motif. However, after so much time had passed since visiting the world in 2007, with 28 Weeks Later, it was deemed more appropriate to name the film 28 Years Later. So, I mean, and it makes sense. I mean, if you had done months, that would have meant that, like, not much time had passed since that first film.
Yeah, 2 years and some change.
And there's no way I wanted to see any of those people just de-aged. It's okay.
Yeah.
And on top of that, like, The Walking Dead kind of did that whole thing where, like, they played, like, the series is set out, like, so much time after the breakout. But they did one that was, like, immediately at the start of that breakout. And it was okay. It just, it was all right. Another key piece of information. The film was primarily shot using iPhone 15 Pro Maxes, which makes this film the biggest feature-length movie to be shot on a smartphone. I attached an article here because I figured, like, if you guys wanted to go a little bit more in-depth. Like, Danny Boyle has a unique reputation for this particular franchise to utilize at least some form of low-tech type of filming. In the first film, he uses what's called like a GL1, which is a camera that was on the lower end of, like, it was more portable. It used mini DVs, if you remember mini DVs, Spencer.
Yep, I do.
And so it allowed for them to film a lot of those, like, fast moving scenes where they're running after everybody. You know, it was a lot easier to manage and it was easier to create those kind of chaotic moments. So for him to take the effort, and now, mind you, it's not 100% shot on a smartphone, this particular film. It still has some drone shots and then some other camera footage, like action cams being like things like GoPros or whatnot, like using those cameras as well. But and truth be told, and we'll go over it in a second, like, there are a couple times where you realize, like, oh, this is definitely on iPhone.
Yeah.
Another piece of information, after the release of 28 Weeks Later in 2007, producer-writer Danny Boyle stated that a third movie in the series had been mapped out, with the proposed working title 28 Months Later, as we stated. But writer Alex Garland said in 2010 that, quote, when we made 28 Days Later back in 2002, the rights were frozen between a group of people who no longer talk to one another. And so the film will never happen unless those people start talking to each other once again. There is no script as far as I'm aware. After a little progress over the years, Boyle and Garland finally announced in 2019 that they were both working on the project again, confirming in 2023 that it was ready to enter production. The film was finally able to gain traction in 2024 when producer Andrew McDonald managed to buy the rights to the first film back from Searchlight Pictures, which he then sold to Sony Pictures under the condition they agreed to fund the sequels. Although Boyle gave Garland the choice to direct, the latter indicated that he wanted to focus on writing after directing Civil War back in 2024 and Warfare, which is the one that's coming out this year, nearly back to back. So, and again, if you're not familiar with Alex Garland, Alex Garland's actually pretty well known right now with his work in Civil War. He did Annihilation. I'm pretty sure there's a ton of other ones that the intern might have ready to kind of mention.
He was a writer for Ex Machina. He was a writer for one of the Devil May Cry video games, or a lot of them. He worked on part of the screenplay for Dread. And you've already covered a good amount of the ones that he's done, that he's worked on.
So those are the ones he's written for. What about his directing?
His directing, he has.
He directed Civil War, Men, Annihilation, and Ex Machina. I mean, those are the bigger ones. So, okay. So diving into this particular review, obviously, this is a movie where we're going to try to tiptoe on spoilers, but there are certain things we're going to talk about that will have to be mentioned. So that way we can kind of keep the conversation going. So everybody be warned.
Spoilers.
Spoiler alert. So let's talk about expectations. This movie is one that we stated it does come with two predecessors, you know, 28 days later, 28 weeks later. So have you seen both of those, Spencer?
Yes.
Okay, you've seen...
Very long time ago.
Yeah, same here, same. And then, Sarah, you've seen the first one?
Yeah, I saw 28 weeks later. I did
28 days.
28 days later. Did not say see 28 weeks later.
So let's start with the most freshest viewing of these films with Sarah. What were some of your expectations going into this film after seeing 28 days later?
Sort of my expectation was, with not knowing what the second movie was about, maybe it was a continuation on like where the characters from the first one were at, or we were just going to follow an entirely different group who's probably from the mainland or the area where Cillian Murphy's character was in the first one. People who are still living on that part of London, Britain area. So that was mainly my like expectations was like it was a continuation of maybe there are different people who are surviving out there on specifically that part of the land.
So, but that's like story wise. Like, what were some of your expectations as far as like the experience as well? Like, did you think they were gonna have it as a lower tech type of filming? Did you think like some of those kind of expectations as well?
So some of like production,
or even like emotional expectations as well, like. You saw the first film, so you know all the things that happened. Did you expect any of those things to happen in this film? Did you expect it to be different altogether? Like, that's the expectations we're talking about here.
Pardon me, my bad. a little bit, yes.
She's like, I hope it's a sequel. That's what I hope it is.
Because for like how the first one went, the unsettling just... It had both a vibe of, okay, we're surviving, sad, okay, we're together, it's going to be all right, to, one of those types of feelings upon watching, like a sense of hope, but also a sense of lack of faith in other people's judgment and morals. And yeah, that's part of my like expectation. For shot wise, I was down for like it looked like it could only go up from there. And yeah, pass. I'm like,
All right, Spencer.
Experience with the franchise.
What were some of your expectations?
Okay, so yeah, I saw the first one like ages ago on a whim and really enjoyed it. Like, really left an impact.
Wait, on a whim?
Yeah.
So how long ago did you see it? Like, did you see it like when it first came out, or did you see it after the fact, like at home?
After the fact at home. It was like, I want to say maybe 05, 06, somewhere around there.
Okay. I mean, that's kind of when like, I guess the zombie movie kind of trend started picking up. So I guess, you know. Okay.
Saw it then, was impressed. Sequel came out, watched that, was interested, not as impressed. It was not that it was bad, but it wasn't that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely like a step down.
Well, especially since you want to punch some people in the face. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which is a trend across these movies. Before this one came out, they released a trailer, and my catchphrase on this show is the trailers are lies. But this trailer was phenomenal. Didn't really tell you a whole lot, but like did a great job of like building up like anticipation.
I do have to say, the one thing this trailer did is it didn't lie, but it did give misdirection. And I'll talk more about it as we talk about the show, talk more about the movie in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Cause the moment like we get to a certain point, I'm like, that's not what the trailer showed me. But it was like, it was a good misdirection. It was like, okay, it was a pleasantly received one as opposed to like Disney just flat out saying, oh, they're going to be in this movie. Yikes. Like it's like, I'm not coming in expecting to see Sylvester Stallone and I get, you know, Timu, you know, Chris Hemsworth or whatever. You know, it was still all in there. It didn't place the pieces in a way that I expected to see how the movie would fall out with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't learn anything more after that first trailer. I was like, I'm sold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I'm in that same boat. Like some of my biggest expectations were that Danny Boyle has a very unique way of doing his filmmaking, whether if it's back to like Trainspotting in those days or like his work with, you know, with this franchise. He has a very unique style of creating unique moments in hard times to create a balance, I guess is the best way to put it. You know, he was the one who directed like 127 hours.
Yeah, Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, Slumdog Millionaire. So, and then obviously things like Yesterday, which if you guys remember is the one about the guy, you know, who remembers all the Beatles songs. but like he knows how to balance that bright positive with the deep, like somber heart tugs, like the heart squeeze moments, fairly well. And sometimes it's a very abrupt transition, but it's there and it just seems to balance it out. And so I've never really had a moment where I've looked at any of his movies and I'm like, well, eh. I mean, cause if you look at everything he's done up until now, like everything has had a sense of balance. And so my expectation for this was like, how is he going to fit that in this movie? Cause like 28 Days Later was pretty bleak.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do you, and I vaguely remember 28 Weeks. Cause all I remember is like, I was in and out in that movie. Like, but this one, I'm like, okay, they're coming back. There's a lot more new faces to it. Obviously, there's a whole new cast altogether. There's a new kind of situation as to where they are in this story, in this universe. What exactly is he trying to tell with Alex Garland's writing? And what are we going to get out of it? And how is it going to be iconically Danny Boyle's? So, but we all got a chance to see the movie. We all got a chance to check it out. And let's talk first impressions. Let's start with the newbie over here, little Miss Sarah, intern Sarah. Why don't you tell us your first impressions?
So I needed a bit to process my feelings about this movie. Nothing bad. It was beautifully shot, and the story and the acting moved me, and it also floored me. So that like. First thoughts leaving the theaters is I haven't seen a horror movie specifically for the zombie genre that has made me look inward and look at my world around me and just go, oh, not in a bad way, in a, oh.
Oh, what?
Like, yeah, like, you're just.
Like, oh, it goes into the story. Like. Like. And again, I'm still like, I recently.
She's been spending too much time with intern manager Amy with those responses. Like, that's how I felt. Like, so I think I get where you're coming from. I think I hear it.
I'm just going to pass.
But go ahead, Spencer. First impression.
Okay. I knew this was a trilogy we were walking into, but man, was I sad that this movie ended. Because I was like, we're going great places. Like, yeah. I kind of wanted to just like keep going. That like, that's just like the mark of a good movie. It's like when it ends, you're like, I'm not ready to be done with you, actually. I'm just excited. The wait's not that long. But what about you?
No, I agree. I'm in the same boat. Like I absolutely was like quelled of my fears as far as Danny Boyle's ability to balance in this particular one, because this movie had really dark and deep moments, moments that really caused you to not only just weep with the characters you see, but also like internally, you know, gut check yourself and everything. And then it kind of switches gears on there real quick, like almost instantaneously. And you're like, what the heck is happening? And I'm on board for it. Like this absolutely felt like a train ride to Crazy Town. And I want a ticket, please. Like I am ready for the next one to come about. And so, yeah, let's kind of dive into that and talk about some of the performers in this film. And I guess some of the key performers that we have right now, obviously, is let's look at Aaron Taylor Johnson's character.
Craven himself.
No. But Aaron Taylor Johnson is in this movie. He plays a dad. And ultimately, like we stated at the beginning, like this small town has kept its, you know, security because it's on an island.
It's really well fortified.
Yeah, really well fortified. I mean, there's no way in or out except for that one little causeway. And it's like, okay, that's smart. Mm-hmm. But Aaron Taylor Johnson plays, he's great in the film. He's, you know, you would think because of the name Power that he would have more screen time, but he's not. Like, he's not the focus of this movie. And that's great, because if it was for the sake of his name, and who he is and what he's been in, like, oh, Kraven the Hunter, the fact that he would have more screen time, but I'm glad that wasn't the case. And they gave him just the right amount of time on the screen. The other side to that, gotta say, Alfie Williams, who played
Spike.
Aaron Taylor Johnson's character's son. Phenomenal job.
This is so wildly impressive for this being his first like theatrical outing. Like, he carried this movie on his back and did 100%. A phenomenal job.
Like, that whole latter half of the film is pretty much all him.
Yeah.
And he carries this movie so well and so well directed. Like, he takes the instruction and the direction, or whatever he took for liberty as far as for himself. Like, honestly, it showed up on screen. He knew what he was doing.
And he made it feel real. And that was the thing that like made me just in amazement and wonder of his performance. Of if you didn't tell me this was his first cinematic outing as an actor, I would have just assumed that he's done prior projects. And I've been like, I need to see what else this kid's been in. Like,
well, he has been in other things, but this is his first film debut.
Yeah, film debut. Because the debut.
Because he was in, he played in a role in A New Breed of Criminal, some film like that. And then he was in an episode of His Dark Materials. He played Ghost Theo.
But still.
Yeah,
but
no, still. Mind you, yeah, all bit parts. But this, to be quite frank, he was the leading man in this movie. He was absolutely the one in charge. And the one leading the charge for the performances in that latter half, like every single person who worked with them, it felt like they were working with a veteran actor. And I kid you not, when I read that, I'm like, there's no chance on God's green earth that this is his feature film debut. I scoured the whole internet in a, you know, 0.28 second search to see like what else he may have like led in, you know, what, you know, theater performance, high school play, you know, middle school, whatever, busking on the corner of whatever street. Like, I tried to find anywhere else where he's actually been, you know, kind of front and center. And yeah, this is it for him. Like, this is his debut. And if ever there was a great start to have in your acting career, it is this way to do it. Like, he came out swinging for the fences and Babe Ruth this sucker.
Yeah.
Like, easily. So I think it's pretty plain to see, like, if he doesn't get acknowledgement and understanding of other opportunities to come within Hollywood, within the film circles, like, people must be blind, because he absolutely killed it in this role. And, I can't wait to see him in more. In fact, he's going to be... There's a sequel already kind of, I don't think it's a sequel. I think it's like a spinoff or whatever, but 28 years later, The Bone Temple, there's another movie that's being made, or whatever it is, because the way streaming services are nowadays, it might be, you know, streaming to streaming to HBO Max.
Or, no, it's a movie.
Well, let's hope. I really do. Like, again, the nature of the world around us right now, we went from enjoying a Saturday to bombing places. So, things change on a turn of a dime. So, I don't take anything for granted as far as just because it says it here doesn't mean it's going to be the same case for it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Any other performers you guys want to highlight?
Raphael Fiennes.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Lord Voldemort himself.
Yes. Just
came into this movie like doing lots of odd things from a distance, but then was just a delightful doctor and just brought a lot of heart and light into the movie, which was actually quite odd and nice.
Because that was going back to what I was saying about the trailer made him out to be like some kind of weird, like Island of Dr. Moreau psycho character who I half expected was going to be somebody who's going to try to take their brains or take, you know, the thing that they had that they were carrying in that third act of the film, like was going to take that and then do like horrific things. Like I thought his intentionality was a lot more macabre and, you know, nefarious based on the trailer. And this was one of those instances where I was like, you got me. But it was like a good you got me, because Ray Fiennes was absolutely phenomenal.
I fully agree on both those. I want to add to to Alfie.
Uh huh.
So I'm finding with adaptations and in the horror genre that we're having like in this current decade, young actors who, when it's their first film, occasionally that like beautiful, beautiful performance. Cause I'm trying to rope in so people can listen to a previous episode. Mason Thames, like his first cinematic or his first film debut was Black Phone.
His first feature film debut.
And guess where he went? How to Train Your Dragon. Which I was trying to see for the girl who played Gwen in the Black Phone, if she had something similar. But we're having a lot of young actors where like they just reach into something in their soul and it's pretty. Another performance I want to highlight, Jodie Comer, who played the mom,
Isla.
Right. Yeah. I want to highlight her because her performance was really good and she made you worry about her, but also know that she could, like, I don't know how to explain it. I really liked her performance.
She had to just do a lot of balancing in her performance of being fine and then being not fine.
A lot of physical acting, yeah.
Yeah, like being all over the place, which was very interesting to watch.
Well, and you take into account, like, when you're playing that kind of role, it does become, like, super labor-intensive because you have to be manic 1 second and then you have to be lackadaisical the next. And in the scope of her performance in this role, like, she was unwell, let's put it that way. And in this particular capacity, that level of unwellness had to translate to certain moments where it manifested in a physical way. So for her, it was a lot going on. Not so much as like she wasn't somebody who like had to be running or shooting or doing all these things, but like it's still just as labor intensive. But on that same switch, she also had to be, you know, cognizant of being a mom and at the same time being within the mindset of having her unwellness. It's a lot. And the fact that she pulled it off very well, it was very believable. Like I was drawn into her performance. I felt for her. I felt for the family, you know, and it just created such a investment of like time and energy into like their journey that you are rooting for all of them in the end of all of it, no matter what anyone's done. So what?
The dad I don't root for.
I mean, to a certain extent, like, so So Aaron Taylor Johnson's character, he's the dad to Spike. From a perspective of a dad, it's in the level of what's going on in the situation. Obviously, there's a dire situation. Like, there's an understanding there that, like, you can't really quite quantify until you've
lost.
Well, until you see things from all angles, and and I'm not saying like the things that he did in the movie were okay, but what I am saying is like, for the scope of depravity, for the scope of not having, you know, enough food to where bacon is a precious commodity, to not have, you know, not having all the latest and greatest of things or technology or certain elements on, you know, available at hand to where, and then on top of that, you have the situations like with what's going with the mom, like, again, the scope of depravity and whatnot leads people to certain choices. Roads and choices. And so, again, humanity is imperfect. And I think that's kind of where, like, this movie really pushes you to understand is that humanity is not perfect, but it's within that imperfection that we find ourselves and choose to be who we aspire to be, you know, and in the case of like Aaron Taylor Johnson's character playing the dad, he aspired to just be a good dad.
A good role model.
In spite of whatever was going on with the dynamic of him and, you know, the mother and him and the people around him, like, it's his priorities were to continue to further his son's experience and training and ability to be somebody in a world that he may not be there for at any given time, which is an understandable, you know, place for any father in that situation, to be in a place where you give what you have and what you can within the mindset that someday you may not be there anymore. Like, in the scope of where there's freaking people in the woods that eat you.
Yeah.
Like, and one drop of blood that we've learned from the first film, one singular blob.
That's going to be part of my complaint at the very end. I would like to just foreshadow.
Yeah, we'll get there. One drop of infected blood on your person, it doesn't even have to be bitten. It just needs to find an open wound or an open Orpheus to find a soft tissued membrane to absorb into, and you're gone. You're dead, essentially, at that point. To recognize that even in this current day and age, that mentality for a father is there, but even more so for that situation, it's like, whoa, okay, you know, the stakes are a little higher, the intentionality is a lot different and much more in you know, focused, and stuff happens. Like, it's again, I'm not condoning it, but I'm also, from the scope of where we are now in the world and you know, the mentality they're in, I'm not condemning it either. Like, it's not a good thing, but I can't really say it's not a good thing because of what's going on in the situation. You get what I'm saying? Spence is like looking off in the distance.
Yeah, I'm just considering what you're saying.
Okay.
What does that mean?
That means I'm considering it.
Well, what are your thoughts?
I'm considering it.
What are your thoughts? What is your opinion?
I don't know. I feel like...
So let's go ahead and put it out on the table. So, because we're kind of dancing around it. So the father is essentially, so it's the father, the mother, and the son. They live in a house. This island is very like small town, Scottish, you know, town, no electronics, no technology, no whatever. They just make it work. In the scope of this, the mother seems to be gravely ill. She seems to not have all of her faculties altogether at any given time. She is constantly in pain. It's obvious that there is something wrong. What we don't know is how long this has been going on. And we know that the situation seems to continue to worsen. In the scope of the of Aaron Taylor Johnson's character, the dad, taking his son out for his first outing. They come back, they celebrate. However, the son ends up finding his father cheating on his mother with another woman. In the scope of everything else, obviously that's horrible. That's horrendous. That's not something ideal, obviously. In the scope of what the dad is trying to do, the dad is still trying to make sure his son knows whatever about living out in the world. The son really does take offense to it, and he absolutely begins to hate on his dad and hate his dad pretty much because he sees them and just focuses on taking care of his mom at that point. Now, again, in the scope of the story, we don't know. Like, we don't know if there was an understanding with the parents at all. Like, again, that's why I'm saying I don't know the full story. But in the scope of everything else that was going on, you know, it drove the story forward. That's as much as I can say. But outside of that, like, the other characters, there's, I forgot what we were even talking about before any of this came up.
We were talking about the story and rooting for that by the end of, like, end of the act, that we're rooting for all the characters to be all right. And the thing I would like to add for the dad character, just so that we can move on to focusing on story.
I was trying to get off of that dad character, but you keep wanting to go back. I'm like, sheesh, Sarah. Well,
the other thing that I can't condone was, so I understand and I recognize that the dad brought Spike off the island so that basically in the case if something were to happen and the island and the runway got infected or alphas came through and something were to happen, Spike could hold his own. The thing that I don't condone was when Spike found out and went back home and he didn't go to the party because the town threw a huge party for him. And his dad comes back the next morning and he plops onto the bed where Spike and the mom is sleeping and Spike's uncomfortable and he's just like, oh, like he's pretending it's all fine. And then he gets up and leaves and goes, oh, I'm going to go make breakfast. And he doesn't really interact with the mom. And it's upon when Spike is trying to talk to him and then basically confronts him and he's just like, is mom all right? It's the genuine concern of a kid worrying about one of his parents and being like, is mom going to be okay? And the dad, like, they're simultaneously protecting the kid of being like, oh, I don't know. And, oh, for doctor, like telling him basically the scope.
You know, you're giving pretty much the entire movie that we said we weren't going to be going towards. So what is it that you're trying to say?
He hits his kid and...
What is the point of you, what you're trying to get at?
Don't condone child abuse. Story. I liked the story.
And I mean, talking about the story, I mean, that does bring us to the conversations about what this whole entire franchise has built. I mean, if you look at everything from the beginning up until now, even every single zombie movie that has come about since 2002 has ultimately bit off the motif, if you will, of the way the zombie construction is, you know, the makeup of what is a zombie in a zombie movie. You know, zombies are no longer from, like, you know, George A. Romero's time frame where the zombies are slow moving, as much as they are like this, you know, slow moving, you know, bulldozer that can't be stopped. In this case, they are essentially these entities that are fast and they can't be stopped.
Which is horrifying.
Absolutely horrifying. Which brings back like all the memories from the first film. It's like all those scenes like in the tunnels and all that were just absolutely like, imagine going to theaters and seeing that kind of stuff. Like it was absolutely freaky. But everything that came about after the fact was like, you had things like with Resident Evil, you had things like the remake of Dawn of the Dead, which capitalized on that as well. You had everything else that came about as far as zombies, when it was in the element of more focused on horror, they were fast moving. They were quick. If there was in the element of like comedic or satire, they were like zombies of old. They were like the zombies from like that George A. Romero era, you know? So this coming into this one was very interesting when this particular story takes that and adds another layer to it. You know, because in this particular one, they weren't just all fast. In this one, you had slower, crawly ones. And then you had, as Sarah had already stated a little bit ago, the alphas, which are unique in itself because those seem like something straight out of a Resident Evil movie.
Well, I think what's interesting about these is that, like, they're not technically zombies, and that lets them have, like, a plasticity to them to where you can kind of maneuver them to do new things.
Aren't they, though?
That's why you can shoot them in the neck and they die.
But that was all of them.
You can't do that with regular zombies.
Yeah.
No.
They talk about shooting them in the neck or the head.
That's not going to work.
That's when Spike shot his first one.
I'm talking about not in this movie.
Oh, you're talking about the alphas.
No.
Oh, you're talking about it in general.
In general.
Okay.
Because you can't do that in a zombie movie. That's not going to really fix your problem.
No. You're right.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I mean, the unique aspect for this particular movie is, like, you have this unstoppable beast fighting against this very intentional and heartfelt mission, so to speak, that takes place in the third act. All the while, I hate to say this, but it kind of got a little Jurassic Park 3 with...
What specifically are you talking about from Jurassic Park 3?
When they have the things that the raptors are looking for and they're being pursued by the raptors.
Wait, Jurassic Park 3 or Jurassic World 3? Sorry.
Jurassic Park 3.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Have you seen that one, Sarah?
No.
You haven't seen Jurassic Park 3?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I think you would have gotten it had you seen it. But I think the bigger thing to kind of take away from all this as well is, like, the zombie character, the general zombie, is no longer like the bigger threat. It seems like in this one, the bigger threat are the ones that control the zombies. I don't know. What do you think, Sarah?
I fully agree with that because some of the additions to the zombie genre, specifically like The Last of Us, they give you for the infected a more like simultaneously, like, I'm trying to find a way to word this properly without being like these unstoppable like creatures, beings and undead, like, can't really be stopped. They give them some sort of humanity in it, and also just like I lost my train of thought.
What are you trying to get at?
I don't even know anymore. Like, for zombie genre, for, like, Last of Us with the infected, there's a sense of part of the person who gets bitten, because it's never by choice. It's either karma or it's a accidental, like we saw in the first movie for 28 Days Later,
mm-hmm.
of like it just happens. You can't control your circumstance. Like, you can take all the precautions, but still there is that unease and it could happen and you could turn. Where if I think The Last of Us, and you can correct me if I'm wrong because I know both you and Spencer are gamers, that the infected have had a sense of still being there, like, mentally, but not being able to control themselves. This movie kind of had, like, a slight aspect of it for some of the infected, not all of them.
Well, and so I don't know if that's fully the way it goes for
a lot of zombies.
For The Last of Us. I don't, which is why, like, it's so heart-wrenching when you have, like, that one scene in the game where you have to shoot the little boy, like, the little boy who ends up getting infected. But the case is that, for this particular film, because it's a rage virus. So it's the virus that occurs that gets passed from person to person via their blood.
Blood or spit.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of mentality of zombie isn't so much as like the direct meaning of it where it's like the undead. It's more so of, because even in The Last of Us, it was more so of an infection, but it completely took over the person itself. So immobilizing the person's own free will.
Yeah. Which and is, they're mentally still cognitively there, but they can't control.
I don't think so.
It was something someone brought, like, apologies.
Because, like, the whole mentality of, like, the cordyceps thing is, it's based on, like, there's an actual fungus that does that to ants and so forth, where they inhabit the brain of the ant, and then they essentially take over the ant and use the ant as a way to get its own food and stuff like that, to where the ant is no longer cognitive, it's no longer able, it's essentially just a car that the fungus drives. It's the same concept there. And in this particular case, I don't know, because it didn't really explain as far as like any of the progression for the rage virus. We've obviously spent at least 3 decades with this. And it seems like at certain points in time, like the world grew and continued on without that side of Europe. Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a sec. But there's also an element where like not a lot of research has been done within these quarantined areas.
I think it's because it's really hard to have a whole functioning research wing.
No, without a doubt, without electricity or technology. I agree. Like, and so that's kind of the place that we're at here.
And also nature took over, which I might sound really outlandish for this, but some of the infected kind of mimic animals, like the ones that are crawling, eating the worms, like a couple of them, and with the running and them being in packs, kind of like, it sounds really like weird to put it like that, that the infected human beings ultimately, when left alone or avoided, reverted to basically animalistic.
Well, and so that's to a sense, I think also in,
weirdly,
if you're looking at like the base instincts of all humanity, the old scientific methodology is that all humanity is essentially an evolved form of animals. So when people fall to their baser, you know, levels or their baser mindsets, they're more animalistic. So I think that's kind of where they're leading towards with that. Because we also see that in Will Smith's I Am Legend with those particular individuals who, again, in that same aspect, they're infected, right?
Yeah.
Spence, they're infected by whatever it is that they were working on, that Will Smith and his team were working on. And ultimately are, to a sense, animalistic in the way they hunt, in the way they, you know, socialize, in the way they, you know, everything, like everything is animalistic. So I think it's just recognizing that the de-evolution of the mentality from once you're in this state only continues to digress to its baser levels as opposed to whatever it is, and it doesn't really talk about it, but whatever it is that makes up like these alphas where they stand out, they're not only intellectually smarter, but they're also physically of a higher tier type of human, because they're not susceptible to the same types of, you know, weapons. They're not susceptible to the same types of blows. They're not susceptible to the same types of tricks that the people use to make sure that they avoid these zombies, so to speak. So
they're like the bloaters from Last of Us, where it has the hard shell.
I don't know, because it's like, it's more so of like a Samson version of like the leader of the Morlocks. Like if you've seen the Time Machine movie with Guy Pearce, what is his name? Why am I drawing a blank? The actor, Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons plays the leader of the Morlocks in this one, but he's much more intelligent. He can speak, you know, very eloquently. It's like if you had that level of intelligence plus the higher strength and ability of a regular Morlock, that's what this guy was pretty much. Like, he couldn't speak at all. He grunted, that we knew of. He grunted and did a lot of that. But outside of that, like, you didn't really know much of what else was going to happen with this particular character, or how much, how evolved he actually was.
Right. That could just be, you know, something they're saving for the next couple of stories.
Or that research part, too, as well, that we were talking about. Because part of the story, you get this, which is a very odd inclusion, but it happens for a reason. You get this inclusion of this this group of troopers, like these troop soldiers who end up getting chased in the midst of all the other chaos that's going on or whatever. You see these three well-dressed, like, well, you know, geared out soldiers who are ultimately running from these. Do they give a name to these things, to the zombies? Because I don't know if they're actually classified as zombies, but.
Oh, like them in a group? Besides the infected, not really.
Yeah, they're just listed as, like, infected. Yeah. Like, okay. Like, so they're running from a group of infected, you know, and ultimately only one is left. But he ends up finding Spike and his mom out in the middle of nowhere. And so when you see him and they meet up, he creates a lot of great interactions. It's really fun. But in the midst of that interaction, like, he's got a modern weapon. He's got modern tactical gear. And he's got a cell phone. And not only does he have a cell phone, but his cell phone has pictures, like, of his ex-fiance who is literally in, like, a club with a drink, like, with a modern-looking drink.
Yeah.
Which kind of lends itself to the mentality that the world has continued on and has left this portion of Europe to its own devices, to being quarantined.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's such a, at first I was like, what the heck is this? Like, what does this have to do with anything? Who are these guys? Like, right? But then the inclusion of that information in there is like, oh, they're wanting people to know that the world is still doing its own thing, and, like, they're treating this as, like, the dirty little secret that we send, you know, we slide the food under the door every now and then,
we
don't talk about it.
Well, I mean, sounds like they're not even doing that. They're just
true.
Technically, they're just being like,
they're just opening the door and checking if they're still alive at that point.
Well, I think what they're doing is
checking the locks.
They're checking the door to make sure that everything is still locked, and they're over there, and they haven't changed to where they can just get off that island.
Yeah, very much.
Because, like, if that was a thing, like, they'd have to, like, nuclear strike all of the UK.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's not tolerable.
Which you would think, like, that's, if that were the direction of where things had gone, easily the world powers would have said, okay, let's just get rid of it so we don't have to worry about it, start fresh.
Oh, no, there'd be an immediate backlash.
Yeah. True.
Because you know there are people there who are perfectly fine. And, like, if you're killing, like, all of the UK, there's going to be a lot of people who are
out of everybody at this table, you are the only person who's seen Civil War. The writer and director of Civil War wrote this movie. Do you honestly feel that if they decided to go in the direction where this virus had reached a lot further out, that they wouldn't have written in?
No, see, and you already said it. Like, if it had gone farther out.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But like, it hasn't. And so, because it's an over there thing, people are going to be upset because, like, it's over there. It's not here. I don't have to worry about it. If it was, like, a threat to them, they would suddenly flip their mind and be like, yeah, let's stop this before it's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Which makes you wonder, like, how far out inland it goes. Because that's just by that coastal area.
I assume it's the whole of UK since it's mostly up to an island.
Up to where is what I'm wondering.
They showed a map. Like, they showed a map earlier in, like, the film.
But yeah, it was the UK.
Yeah. It was, like, primarily nearly all the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric, which is the soldier who came in and had the phone, brought up that, like, as you said, the world's kind of just moved on. They're like, okay, like, there's this happening over here, but, like, it's the, oh, you guys are fine. Okay, yeah, they can take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. But we'll send, like, a couple people to make sure that, like, we don't want it to come, like, it's the rich person mentality of like, oh, you really need help? Don't, we'll help you. Don't touch my arm. Don't touch my arm. Like, it's that really rude, like, rude, but also just like self-preservation of like, okay. Like, Eric brought it up where he could have been a delivery driver.
Yeah.
And he said, once you step on foot on this island, you step foot here, there's not really a safe way for you to get back out.
Well, and even more so, like in that sentence that he says, like he talks about, like, you know, he could have been a delivery driver. Do you know what that is? Like when people, you know, order stuff on the internet or online and then, you know, they have to be delivered to people's houses, whatever. It's like so much is like existing outside of their world. It's like, dude, this is the intentionality is probably like, this could possibly be happening right now, and the world would be like never, like none the wiser. And I was just like, I was like, okay, I see what they're trying to do. Like, it is very telling as to why he is in this particular scene, why he's important, because he's just laying out like, you guys are like the butthole of the world. Nobody cares about you unless you start flaring up. Like, yeah, quite literally, you are just, we are just here to check to make sure that you haven't like destroyed yourselves. We're just making sure the locks are still on.
Yeah.
And as a character, it was like that character, if you didn't go into that and just be like, oh, there's a soldier. Well, soldier go bop. Like, Eric as a character did so much for the story of just reflecting. You have the characters inside and being quarantined, and technically have the separate of, you have the mainland, you have the island, and then you have the soldiers who come from outside of the mainland and them just coming in. It's the perspective of, okay, we're surviving, and the greedy, well, what do I get from helping you? Which is literally what Eric does.
Yeah.
He, best story, he come, like, his character is introduced to Spike and, wait, did we?
His mom.
And his mom. And he saves them. And then he immediately follows it up with, so do you know the main mole really well? Well, why did I help? Like, it's the...
It's, you know, a this for that.
Like, yeah, it's a this for that, and not a, okay, I just, like...
Well, see, yeah, the problem is that I think, very specifically, Eric is a jerk.
Oh, yeah. Oh, mom said straight up. She's like, no, I know a jerk when I see
which
a jerk.
Which is hilarious, is that she just became very lucid and was like, no.
Yeah.
And a shot zoom in on his face where he's just like... Like, it made me laugh in theaters, and I felt really bad because it was dead silent. I'm like, ah! I'm like, oh, wait, shoot.
Yeah, it definitely makes a point to, like, recognize in that lucid moment where she has a moment of clarity. She's like, oh, yeah, he is one. Oh, yeah, I know one when I see one. Like, it was a really great moment.
It also speaks to, basically, humanity and desensitizing yourself to, basically, other people's suffering.
Well, I think
him as a character.
Yeah, I think this whole movie is that. Yeah. Like, this whole movie is an effort to recognize, like, we people are endowed with this mentality to constantly be raising soldiers in an era of it's us versus them. Mm-hmm. And in this particular movie, it's so black and white that the us is the people who are, you know, on that island, those that are surviving, and it's the people who them are the infected.
And any rogue humans.
Yeah.
Well, and even in that, like, oh yeah, any human who acts outside of the norms of what is expected without asking questions, without getting clarity.
Well, I mean, we only have that one instance with them talking to that doctor that Raphael Fiennes plays, but like, that could just be their standard, like, hey, don't interact with anybody.
Yeah, well, like, if it seems off, don't just ostracize it. Don't even worry about it.
Well, no, because, like, they could be doing, like, Walking Dead things, like, hey, if, like, you let, like, even say hi to people, they could follow you back, and then we have to deal with real people wanting our stuff.
Mm. I don't think that was the case. Like, it didn't seem like they were, like, not willing to bring people back. It looked like they were more willing.
When did they say that? Like, when were they willing to do anything for anyone else?
When were they not? Like,
when were they?
Again, you're stating an argument that wasn't said, and I'm giving a counter argument that also wasn't said, but you're saying yours is right?
I'm just saying it doesn't make any sense because like earlier in the movie, like what's her face? I forget the name of the lady who's at the gate. Like she's like
the elder woman.
Yeah.
Claire. I don't know.
Like she's saying no one's coming to save you and like shows them the graveyard of like the times where they've done that.
Yeah.
And that kind of would lead to the fact that they're probably distrusting of other people.
True, but it isn't also stating that they wouldn't allow other people in.
But you gotta vet those type of people.
Yeah, they probably do like a vetting.
How would you vet someone?
You check their eyes? I mean,
you can check they're infected. You can't check if they have malintent.
I mean, yeah. there's again, that's a whole other subplot that you're assuming that they haven't even touched on in this movie.
Yeah.
You're putting your own ill nature on people and wondering, it's like, your distrust of people.
Zombie-esque movie. These are the rules.
And also according to how many zombie movies have you seen outside of asylum films?
Many? Yeah. That's generally
also in the case of films like this where it basically pits man against man. You have the conflict of at least one person, if let into a group, deciding let's burn it all down. Like,
did an episode of The Walking Dead give you that? Because that seems like the only thing.
That's a very Walking Dead.
Every single person who ever talks about zombies gets all of their information from some episode of The Walking Dead. And I absolutely hate it because there's so much more to zombies than just what The Walking Dead has brought about. But like, I get what you're saying, Spence.
Yeah.
I get the mistrust. That's understandable. Because it's Alex. The only reason why I say this is because it's Alex Garland and it's Danny Boyle. And they create more complex societies than most people really give them credit for. Who knows what the whole makeup, like they didn't give us a whole, you know, a dossier on exactly the roles of the town at that particular point. Yes, there is mistrust. I get that. But like the whole idea of like burning things down and what, like that's, they have to, again, there's
not
no history.
Physically burning things down.
There's no history of it. Like, again, these are all speculations on a story that, we're missing the forest for the trees here. Like the whole purpose, like in my opinion, like the whole purpose is like the fact that they choose to create these stigmas for the mentality of protecting their own, i.e. like with this doctor where they're like, oh, you know, he did this one weird thing and then he waved at us friendly and we ran off. Like that's a stigma.
Yes.
Was there any proof to it? No.
No.
Was there any follow-up? No. Did this last for almost 30 years, apparently, since the inception of all of this, to where they've held on to this stigma? Yes. It's the mentality of, like you were saying, Spencer, the us versus them, and then the infighting based on those assumptions we have of people who are different. And then recognizing that between this infighting of the us versus them mentality, there are people who have and are just thriving because they don't give two farts in space about the people who are actually having that combating against each other. It's like, we'll let the lower class people fight because we're okay. We're fine. I'm pretty sure in the scope of this universe, while these people are scrounging and trying to figure out and getting eaten by things, there's probably somebody ordering Domino's pizza on the other side while playing online video games with somebody on the other side of the world. And also, you know, door dashing a couple of like rock stars. Like, again, the world on the side of haves is thriving and they are choosing to not care about those that are actually dying and hurting. That fighting. And I think that's kind of knowing. And again, I revert back to you because you saw the film. I'm having, especially more so now, I'm having trouble kind of garnering the courage to see Civil War. But like, you know,
I mean, it was set up in a way that couldn't possibly happen because of the California's not siding with Texas on anything.
So, you don't know. I mean, the way things are going now,
especially not now.
I'm just saying there are, I don't know if you heard, the LA gangs are starting to, they're saying that they're putting truces together to help stop ICE. There are people in Texas who are doing similar. Like, this is things that are happening in the world today. Again, we're not talking politics on the show, but I'm just saying, like, the way the world is going, you know, I'm going to be investing heavily in some toilet paper coming soon. But, like, the fact is, like, Alex Garland's, like, way of writing is very indicative of a much larger issue that he sees. And if he sees that there's, like, if he's seen anything in the world as of late, it's that when people are hurting, those that have the resources, who have the ability to usually lend a hand, will more than likely turn their backs first before anything else.
See, the thing is that this universe has a precedent for not helping, because 28 weeks later was about, let's help. And then that blew up in everyone's faces. And, like, that actually unleashed the hordes onto Paris, I believe. And then it had to be pushed back.
True. Again, I vaguely remember that second movie. I don't know. Like, because even when we get to, like, that third act, and that, as we mentioned, you know, there are going to be a couple spoilers. Like, we do get to the third act where we finally meet the doctor, and we get a really great scene out of it where you come to find out the doctor is not anything like he was presented as in the beginning of the movie, or what he was presented as in the trailer of the movie, which, to my, you know, perception, the trailer made it seem like he was a lot more nefarious, and he's just a sweet old doctor. And you know what's crazy? They highlighted so much in, like, it wasn't even marketing, just, like, press and all that. Like, oh, Ray Fiennes is, like, getting built. He's getting jacked. He's getting ready for his next role. This is that. He's got a six pack. I'm like, dude, is he going to be fighting in this movie? None of that. There was none of that in this movie.
Back to back. It could be second one.
True.
Yeah.
That is true. Who knows?
And you never know. That screenshot you saw could have been from that part.
Possibly.
And they're
maybe.
Like, oh, this works better for here.
Who knows? But either way, like, we get a great scene. We get great scenes with him and Spike and his mom. And it lends to, like, a really heartfelt moment. We're not going to talk about it because we want you to see the film. But it does lead to a very beautiful moment in the movie that absolutely, like, tugs at your heartstrings. I'd ask Sarah to explain, but I'm pretty sure she's going to delve deep into everything that we're not supposed to talk about.
No, I'm purposely just not contributing for this part.
Why?
No, because all I want to say is that it was a beautiful
third act. You're contributing.
And that's it.
There you go.
And you did it.
You did it. Good job. Hooray. Hooray. Hey, look. Here you go. Hooray for Sarah. There you go. Woo woo. Okay, I'll turn it up louder for you. There you go. See? But needless to say, like, that whole kind of transition for that scene all the way through to, like, how the film ends, it ultimately lends itself to this just greater, you know, unknown of what's going on in the world, especially with how the movie actually ends.
Yeah.
Because we get a very, like, odd way this movie ends that, again, as Danny Boyle does in his very unique way, we get a lot of that heartfelt, like, somber moments that really feel like, oh my God, it cuts deep. It's, like, really, you know, emotional stuff. And then we transition to that.
Yeah, that was weird. But, like, I'm assuming it doesn't probably hit as hard if you put it at the front of the next one for where they want to chop it up.
Are we doing, like, a Rian Johnson kind of thing with, like, Star Wars here? He looks at the lightsaber and then he tosses it behind him.
Yeah, it's exactly that.
But maybe, like, but it's just, it's so unique how they decided to end it. It's like tracksuit Power Rangers is probably the best way to put it. I don't really know how to better explain
it. I like that, though. That's like, I don't understand what it means, but once you've seen it, you're like, yeah, I guess tracksuit Power Rangers.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's definitely a fun way to end it. I expected I really didn't know what to expect as far as an ending. Like, I thought we were going to kind of get like a Incredible Hulk, like walk off into the distance, like kind of thing. Like, but no, it actually ended pretty uniquely. But I think overall, like, this movie is bringing about another kind of recognition to the idea that societal topics and even political topics can be great basis for impactful movies. And the fact that everybody, not everybody will tune into CNN, not everybody will tune into, you know, their latest NPR, not everybody's going to flip on, you know, their news app to see what's going on, but a good amount of people are going to go see this movie and a good amount of people are going to recognize, why is nobody helping these unequipped, under technologically, you know, savvy people? Who's going to save them? Who's going to help them? Who's going to help fix the problem that's with the infected? Who is going to, you know, who out there in this universe can actually do some good?
Yeah.
It's taking action instead of saying words. You can say words, but it's until you take action that it, like, you show up. Because probably, for all we know, and speculating, that the people outside of the quarantine area are like, oh yeah, I had an aunt over there. I think she's doing just fine. Mm. They'll figure out a way to basically, we have it quarantined, they'll figure out a way to basically get it taken care of. That's their problem.
Mm.
It's one of those things of, oh, I like, another speculation, I have an aunt in there. Yeah, I'm thinking about visiting her like sometime this weekend. Like, it's saying it, but not following up and doing.
Well, and I think to Spencer's mentioning earlier, like that quarantine, like, perimeter, I'm pretty sure they work extra hard to make sure that perimeter stays intact. However, that's what I'm wondering. Like, I don't know how far inland it is. Because again, I remember what happened in the last movie, but from 2007 till about now, that's a lot of time in between.
18 years.
Okay, it's been 18 years.
No, from 2007?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she was right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm saying that because
So in that time frame, like, who knows how far out it actually has gone, and if, like, is there an actual quarantine line? Is there a wall? Is there, like...
The ocean.
Inland, Spencer, inland.
No, all of it is the quarantine.
You mean
zone.
Europe and Asia?
No, just the UK.
So just the UK by itself?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're okay. All right. Well, there you go.
The UK plus Scotland.
Because didn't it hit Paris in the second one?
Yeah, and then they pushed it back.
But there's still a possibility.
Possibility of what?
That there might still be some infection in Paris.
I mean, possibly, but that map didn't include Paris.
Yeah, but if they also didn't have any...
It's also a bad map if it doesn't include it.
They also don't... When did you see any technology? Did their Garmin miss the last update in 2003?
Sure, they missed a lot of updates.
did their Magellan or whatever type of, you know, whatever. Either way, like again, for the lack of technology and information, like, who knows? And again, these are things where it didn't actually specify where the quarantine zone is now existing. So potentially it could be anywhere. But like you said,
I mean, that seems like it's a lot harder to control if
true. No, 100%. I agree. But we don't know. Like, you're under the assumption that, you know, best practices, yeah, it's only a quarantine to this space. But without information, and we're talking about a potential global type of pandemic that could easily wipe out most of the world, I would say, yeah, who knows? A lot can happen in 18 years. Mm. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Was there any highlights that you guys had for the film?
I'm gonna start. Doesn't go into the story.
Well, I mean, as long as it goes into the story that we've already talked about.
Okay.
So let's start. Apparently, okay. Let's start with Sarah. I feel like we have to start with Sarah.
Can I start off with an issue first? Then
sure.
Highlight. Okay. Getting out of the way. I'm not going to have the septic tank problem again. Issue was because we were introduced to Alpha in the first act, and it was Spike and the dad getting back home, and the Alpha's chasing them. Spoiler alert. When the Alpha gets shot, it's a body of water, blood, and both Spike and the dad were in the water, and like waves. One of them could have gotten infected, but again, I know they checked the eyes, and also getting hurt running. So that was my one thing. Because also, I think in the first film they talked that it gets like much the blood if it gets into blood or spit into a orifice of you, you're infected. And the ladies checked that their eyes were perfectly fine, but also like it takes more than a couple, like it takes a couple of seconds but could take longer for you to turn. So like I'm just saying that maybe the dad should have or could have gotten infected. My highlight is beautifully shot, and it a gobsmack that was on an iPhone, like it kind of just gives the you can do oh like amazement and wonder, and I think it should be up for an award. And okay. my I'm sorry, Spencer, if this is like your highlight too. That soundtrack I need. It was.
I'm gonna piggyback on that because like some pass songs started playing and I'm like tapping my phone. It's like, what is this? It's like,
real.
I have no idea what's going on. I'm like, I have the internet in my pocket. You can't even tell me what these songs are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was annoyed by that.
It's part of the experience of the movie. They actually turn on like a Wi-Fi jammer. So you feel like California. You're, is it?
Yeah.
To do what?
To block signals like that.
Really?
Yeah.
It doesn't stop the ice.
Yeah.
Just saying. hasn't stopped the government yet. So, no, the soundtrack is actually pretty bomb. Yeah. And I think it's just the composition. Mm-hmm. It's not like, thankfully, like it's not a jukebox soundtrack. It's actually a score, which
it's available on Apple Music. I found it. Found 28 years later, wrote original motion picture soundtrack by Young Fathers, 2025. Something's getting listened to tonight while I go to sleep. Lovely.
The composer for this one was Young Fathers.
Yeah,
that's what I just said. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard of them.
I have not.
I have not either. But good job them.
Yeah.
So it looks like
soundtrack.
Yeah, it looks like they've only done T2 Trainspotting, so the second Trainspotting movie. And then they did one of the songs for Assassin's Creed, the movie. Yeah, there's not much else there.
It was a good soundtrack. Like, okay, another highlight.
Oh, you boy.
This movie was This movie was so good that I was locked in. I wanted to Shazam like the soundtrack, but I didn't, and I'm kind of sad I didn't, but also kind of glad I did. Not because I would have been easily distracted.
Okay. What about you, Spence? Do you have any highlights or issues?
Okay. So I think my only other highlight, I'm going to block this whole section of the movie as a highlight, but the section where they're at Dr. Kelson's, like, I just had like a lot of fun there, even though it was still kind of a nightmare, just like swirling about them. But it was like kind of like a light in the nightmare, and it was really nice and fun until it wasn't. Yeah.
Until the Fire Nation
attacked.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any issues?
Issues? No, not really.
We were talking about it earlier, how you were mentioning how there were certain scenes that were fairly obvious that it was on an iPhone.
Yes, the night shots.
Oh, okay.
Because like, I don't even remember what night shot it was. But I was just looking at this, and I'm like, I feel like the grain has gotten just like very dramatic.
Very exponential.
Suddenly.
That's not a issue for you?
No, because that could be intentional. Like, they intentionally wanted something that was grainy, and that's perfectly fine if that's what you want.
Okay. No. As far as highlights for me, yes, the score itself is something that is absolutely otherworldly and very ethereal to fit this particular genre. It's very much a different way to look at, like, a different way to score a zombie movie. Because I don't ever feel like zombie movies are scored like this movie.
No.
And I think that's something to absolutely highlight as a huge plus. But also the careful and meticulous placement of information throughout this movie was very expertly done. And I absolutely loved how this movie culminated, not in a massive, enormous, like, drawn out battle, but this movie, like, climaxes at a point where it is this emotional peak that we all have to understand where ultimate sacrifices lie, essentially. And it's such a peak moment in the movie that it will essentially kind of take your breath away in you know, so many terms, because of how much it impacts the overarching story and the people you've invested in thus far. I don't think, I mean, even in the scope of, like, some of those scenes, like, I didn't really mind some of the footage, like, recognizing that most of it was shot on an iPhone. Literally what I'm holding in my hand is completely bonkers to me, but it only kind of exemplifies how much technology has moved to where movies can now, full-fledged feature films in theaters can be filmed on this little device. So, Spencer, you look perturbed.
Nope.
Okay. Well, that does bring me to the roundtable question for the evening, and that is, considering its influence on the zombie genre and post-apocalyptic storytelling, what do you guys think is 28 years later's most enduring contribution to cinema? And why does it still resonate today? I mean, we mentioned it a little bit ago, how it really changed the name of the game for kind of the construction of the zombie character. It really kind of re-identified zombies as not just like these slow-moving, brain kind of individuals, but it gave more depth to them. It gave more complexity. In fact, zombies were no longer just defined as the living dead, but they were defined as ultimately individuals or entities that were taken over and were no longer in control of their own facilities. Like, they were not in control of themselves at all, ultimately, and pretty much removed from their own equation altogether, like their own will, free will, and you know, ability to decide and feel and so forth. So aside from that, what do you think is ultimately, like, considering its influence, what do you think this particular film's most enduring contribution, maybe not so much this, what do you think about the franchise? Let's talk about the franchise. That contribution is to the overarching, you know, genre of zombie movies. Sarah, you look a little scared over there.
I'm thinking this through because the franchise has contributed the vessel of a entity and a creature, but still tackling topics and subjects of people and mankind as a whole. I don't even know how to put it.
Do you need more time?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Spence, do you need more time as well?
I don't even know how to answer that because it's a franchise. I didn't watch the first two movies. I only watched this one.
But you have seen the first two.
Yeah, but I could only give you, like, vague plot points.
Give me your best guess. Like, let's incorporate this movie as kind of the consistent template from the first one as well.
That's really hard to say because this just came out, so you can't really say what it's going to do in the future.
Well, I mean, though, if this same template was used back in 2001 and seeing how zombie movies have been created since 2001. Like, where, so like, okay, let me go ahead and take the helm on this. Okay.
Okay.
So like, in all honesty, one of the things that I see as the contributing factor for the effect of that franchise on the zombie genre is reinvigorating the fact that zombies were never meant to be the monster in itself. Zombies were meant to be the placeholder.
Mm.
We've known that ever since George A. Romero created that first Night of the Living Dead, recognizing like it was essentially a movie about inequality of you know, with races. It was recognizing racism in a monstrous kind of way. And that was what it was intended. Ever since then, it became more of like a designer type genre. It became something where people could, you know, pretend to do this. And it's like, oh, it's a zombie movie. We're going to kill people. Oh, this is that. It's an outbreak. It's this, it's that. The bastardization of the zombie genre came rampant from the 70s through up until like the early 90s. Like zombies were just like the pop culture thing to put into films. The first 28 days later brought about the mentality that, you know, there are certain powers that be that are behind a lot of things that we see. And they're the ones who create these so-called infected or lesser than. They're the ones who are doing this. And then they step away, or all they want to do is either sweep it under the rug or not take care of it. And there's so much of a societal, like even a political impact on that. As far as implications, there's so much implications on what is going on around the world. I mean, let's be honest, this movie being made, it's so ironic that this movie was in production during the attacks in 9/11. Like, and everything that comes about in this movie, and there's always been this whole like conspiracy theory that the government knew that 9/11 was going to happen, that George Bush knew 9/11, like there's all these little, you know, sentiments. And we as the people, we don't really have full knowledge as to whether or not it's there. We just have the pieces that make up whatever story, whatever rumor. But with everything we continue to see as to how brass and how like upfront now the government is about like, oh yeah, we're just going to do this and we're not even tell you. Or we're just going to do these things and not even tell you. It's like, oh, we're just going to do these things and we'll tell you. And what are you going to do about it? Like at this point in time, it's like, okay, well, maybe there might be some truth to that. Like, and then it drops in 2002 and it's like, did a lot of people go see it in theaters? Probably not. Was there a possibility that the government's like, hey, you know, we probably should like minimize the amount of people seeing this movie because, you know, it's speaking a lot of truth. Like it brought back the importance of having a political statement or having a societal statement within a film to where it's as black and white, easy to see right in front of you.
Like District 9.
Yeah, like District 9. But like this in the capacity of like other zombie movies, like recognizing like this was what it was made to be about. This is what George A. Romero wanted it to be about. Let's remember. And if anything, even as we come to this film, like it's all the more obvious, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What are your thoughts, Spence?
I mean, generally, having, I won't say it like that, but like having like, you know, a movie that is based on a real world fact generally tends to stick the landings a lot better than just abstract. Like, because like, you know, a lot, like as you brought up, a lot of those zombie movies are just using them as the big bads without making a point. And I'm sure those movies aren't nearly as well remembered as ones that do.
Yeah.
Because like, I remember the first 28 days later, not like very specifically, but like I saw that movie like over 10 years ago last time.
Yeah.
And it's still like a little bit still like, because like, I was able to make the connection with this one. I'm like, oh yeah, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So like, I feel like when you are able to relate your movie into a real world situation, you can, one, like highlight your story and make it more topical. And two, you actually kind of can make more of a lasting impression with your movie because it's actually able to relate to the populace.
Yeah. What about you, sir? Any thoughts come to mind?
Fully piggybacking off of both of you, it contributes to the in a worst case scenario what humanity and what someone would do in face of like your like someone close to you turning or the people around you turning, what leads people to make the decisions, roping it back in to make the decisions that they do for their self-preservation, for the preservation of their family, loved ones. It contributes to your ideals and your beliefs on what you would do to basically at the end of the day still be there,
mm-hmm.
no matter who you push down. And you using the vessel of infection, undead, zombies, and not in the, well, it's truly what both of you guys said. Like, they're the big bads. It's the trope of it's people.
Yeah. And again, like, again, going back to, like, the argument that Sarah started earlier about the dad, like, again,
I'm now seeing the circumstances.
The circumstances therein, it's like, again, in the scope of the story element, like, neither condoning nor condemning, but the fact is like, from a standpoint from this, like, it's just, there's a whole other form of logic that kind of takes over for that. And recognizing, like, again, it is not the zombies or the misinformed survivors that are the enemy here, that are the big bads, that are the villains. It's the people that are sitting by watching and not doing anything about. Like, those are the villains in this story. Like, for this particular film, it is not the alphas that are here. It is not the misconceptions of you know, maniacal doctors. It is not the lack of, or misinformation from other folks on the island in the town, or it's not the dad who is struggling to find intimacy with somebody whose mind is getting, you know, slowly taken away day by day from illness and whatnot. Those aren't the big bads in this story. The big bads, the big evil villain people are those that are literally seeing this pop up on the 5 o'clock news and they turn the channel to watch their MTV or to watch their, you know, game shows or watching their Netflix shows. They see it on their phone and they close the app. They're looking at it on, you know, their smart refrigerators and and swiping away so that way they can see their next grocery list. Those are all the villains in this movie. And it's very much in that vein of Alex Garland, but it's also something that, again, is being brought back to the forefront of even more so in this time now, having the ability to recognize that we still have a way to get our voice out there, to get our messages across. So, but let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Sarah.
This movie. Wow. Okay. So basically
this movie passes for me. Everything from the cinematography, the acting, the score. Oh my gosh, the score. I'm going to, out of 5 monocles, I'm going to give it a...
Did it pass or fail?
It passed. I said it passed.
Okay, just making sure.
This has truly been the highlight of my year. So I think it's a perfect film. So 5 out of 5 monocles.
There you go. Pass. What about you, Spence?
Okay, this movie passes for me.
Really well executed movie. I think some of the...
I was wondering at the beginning why you were messing with that.
You actually sounded like the little cat from Emperor's New Groove.
Uh-huh.
Say, this is my voice.
This is my voice.
Okay. Go ahead.
I think this is a really well done executed movie. To piggyback what you were saying about like the real villains and using your voice, I did just find out an interesting tidbit of information.
Ooh.
There's a tie-in marketing website. It's called RageLeaks.net. And apparently someone in universe has started speaking out about, hey, what the heck is going on over here? This does seem to be like a government cover-up type thing is happening, and there's like a whole bunch of files on it. It's actually quite interesting. So I recommend going and check it out. The password is Memento Mori. So check it out if you have a second.
Nice. We'll put that in the episode description. So,
But yeah, no, this movie was really fantastic. When a movie ends and you're upset that you have to wait, well, I mean, it's only 6 months, but...
Still, you have to wait.
So. Yeah. Like, you're generally in a good place unless it was bad. This was not bad.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited and looking forward to more stories. So it's a 5 out of 5 for me as well.
That's right. And just for equity here, hold on.
So this is my voice? So, okay.
Back to normal. As far as this film passes for me. Absolute beautiful story, beginning, middle, and end. Absolutely just drew me in, engaged me, had me... laughing on the edge of my seat, just watching the action, had like pretty much ripped my heart out and, you know, and then gave it back to me and then made me laugh all over again. Like, this movie was a roller coaster ride of emotions, and I absolutely was on board for every single second of it. I don't ever want to see, I don't ever really want to see a zombie movie that doesn't have, you know, a purpose anymore because of Alex Garland and Danny Boyle. Like, the recognition of what they're doing and the tales that they are telling within the 28 Days Later franchise universe, like, I want to see it continue on and I want to see more things happen. This movie will absolutely floor you, and not just for what it gives you at the surface, but also what it does for you underneath the surface. And so much like to my cohorts here on today's show, it's going to get a 5 stars as well from me. I wish that people will gravitate. I hope that people will gravitate to the theaters and really flock in and see this movie, because this has a story to tell. And as we continue to watch this franchise, I am absolutely on board for whatever the messaging is behind it. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out over at our social pages over at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram and Threads at filmlosophy101. You can also check us out over at Blue Sky at filmlosopherspodcast.bluesky. If you check us out there, over at our Instagram page, that's where we post all of our other great content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found on Instagram and Instagram only at Jane on Scene. And I swear she's going to get that Steel Magnolias review in someday. Who knows? But yeah. This movie is an absolute gem. And before I get into that, you can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming. And that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a like or a subscribe. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
Yes, we have.
Also give us a follow too. You might want to give us one of those as well. And then tell us what you think. Did you see the movie? Did you like it? Did you not like it? Did you get the messaging? Did you get something else entirely? Give us your thoughts in the towel section down below. And we love reading those, and we can't wait to hear it. This movie was an absolute delight. And again, we can't stress enough. You need to go see it when you can in theaters. And if you can't see it in theaters, make sure to rent it or download it, via buying, through digital, proper storefronts, and check it out, because it is one that will definitely move you. But we thank you for tuning in, and we hope to catch you next time. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm intern Sarah.
From all of us here, class dismissed.